But it was all that I could do to keep from crying.
Well, you know who had his ashes spread at home plate?
The dude that did the Go Cubs Go song.
Yeah,
wasn't his name Goodman?
Steve Goodman.
You know what else he wrote?
He wrote the perfect country and western song, and then he sent it to either Waylon Jennings or one of those guys.
Well, a friend of mine named Steve Goodman wrote that song, and he told me it was the perfect country and western song.
They read it, and they said, this is almost perfect, but you didn't mention anything about mama or prison.
Because he hadn't said anything at all about mama.
Or train.
Or train.
Or pickup trucks.
Or trucks.
So then Goodwin allegedly wrote the next verse, which was, it was raining the day my mama got out of prison.
The day my mom got out of prison. And I went to pick her up in the rain. And the pickup truck, she got run over by a damned old train. And I'll hang around as long as you will let me. And I never
stocks and jocks.
You are out of control
here, right now.
Hello, North Bank Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Jimmy on the board. S&P futures are up a little bit. They're up by 11. NASDAQ futures down 138. We have Professor Liu.
Good morning.
How are you, bud?
I am I'm awake, which I guess beats the alternative, right?
Are you Walter Brennan? I get up, I sit down at the table, I have my coffee, I read the obits. If I don't see my name, I go to work.
That's it. That's the philosophy for the day today.
Well, that's a good one. How are you guys doing out there? Fire and rain and otherwise?
Real fire danger right now because of the temperature, which is we were hitting regularly over 100 for like 4 or 5 days in a row, which is really unusual for a place at this altitude, and cooled off for a couple of days, and then we're back up, you know, high 90s, low 100s again for the weekend. The real problem, of course, with this stuff is that the humidity drops down to 15%, 10%, and with that incredibly low humidity and the heat, any kind of a spark will start things. So it's dry, it's hot, it's a little windy, and you know, you saw how incredibly dangerous these conditions are with what happened in Spokane.
Yeah,
which I've been to Spokane a couple of times. My one of my kids was assigned there in the Air Force, and to have a modern urban suburb neighborhood just burned to the ground like that. You know, what are the 65,000 people evacuated or something like that?
Yeah, some huge number.
Is just incredible. And I'm amazed it's not getting more coverage.
Well, the news docket is full, shall we say.
I guess. But you would think a major urban fire like that, you know, should get some coverage. And of course now it turns out that it was set.
Well, one of them was. Weren't there about five or six?
Well, there were three, I think, and they know for sure that one of them was set. The one, what they call the Old Trail Fire, which I think originated in a park, and apparently was the one that did most of the damage, or the one that expanded the most. So, you know, that was the story about the Palisades Fire in California too. It was set.
How do you set a whole? Well, if it's that dry in it, whatever, doesn't take much, does it?
Yeah, I mean, if you, they had reports, and it's a combination of sort of malevolence, you know, people who want to start fires, and for the purpose of watching everything burn, versus incompetence or stupidity, which where we have a large, you have a large population of homeless folks who are out trying to cook or whatever, and they are trying to keep warm. If it gets cold at night, they set fires, and this happens.
Well, we have, there's a lot of dumb people that aren't homeless either.
But agreed.
It could be lightning. It could be anything. I mean, I've never been involved in a lightning where there wasn't rain. They say in these areas you get lightning. Lightning starts. Being from Chicago, when you have lightning, you're in the middle of a thunderstorm. I mean, it's usually
raining. We have dry thunderstorms here all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I've never seen that. So I guess it's good or something.
So I'll give you. Let me give you this. This is interesting. We have a house up in the mountains, and one of our neighbors, thunderstorm comes through. We drove through it as we were going up there. Thunderstorm comes through, quick dash of rain, lots of lightning. On his property, he has two trees standing close together, and they were struck by lightning and ignited the interiors of the trees.
Whoa.
No external smoke, no external fire, but the interior of the trees were actually burning. And incredibly dangerous situation, because you don't, there's no visible smoke,
it's like a peat bog fire, for God's sake.
Exactly, but it can burn. It can burn for hours and hours. Everything dries out, and then it eventually erupts, and then you got a full fledged fire. So he's sitting in his house, fat, dumb, and happy, and all of a sudden the fire trucks show up, and they pile out into his front yard and said, "You've got a fire in your place, and it's right over there." And they all look over there, and there's nothing. And he goes, "What? Am I hallucinating, or are you?" And they said, "Give us a second." They go, they cut the tree down. Actually, it was two trees. They cut them down and split them open. And there inside is the glowing red, coals of this thing burning its way through the trunk.
Well,
and he goes, "So the question you should be asking
how do they know
about it? How do they know?" Yeah. That's right. How do it know? And what they do in this little mountain community, the volunteer fire department has a thermal drone. Actually, they have several of them that they launch after these rainstorms or these lightning storms, and they fly down the valleys in the areas where these guys have responsibility. They fly down the valleys looking, spotting hot spots, and they spotted this one. So, pretty good use of technology. Of course, I wonder what else they pick up on that thing.
I was thinking that myself. You out there cooking steaks?
Well, if that's the case, yeah. Or somebody lighting a campfire improperly. I mean, the burn bans in that community are so stringent right now that you're not even supposed to be out charcoaling. You can use a propane grill or a propane heater. But you can't have anything that's setting off sparks like a charcoal barbecue.
Well, I get it.
So that I presume they pick up that as well. But anyway, I thought that was pretty cool.
Well, did you ever see whenever you have like a big fire, Canada, spot, whatever. I mean, not the ones that are set, but you always have some, or even California, some buffoon say something like, "Well, man, if you just had forest management and burned away all the underbrush without having any idea of the..." Did you ever see anybody do that?
Yeah, they do it up around us all the time.
But I've seen them do it over on the lakeshore, in the National Lakeshore in Indiana. They take an area about the size of maybe a football field, and they've got like three fire trucks and about 10 guys, nervous as hell, doing it.
Yeah, control burns get out of control.
But you can only imagine, like, a control burn for, like, Canada or something. I mean, what are you talking about?
I mean, first of all, they don't have to burn the entire forest You know, they don't have to take that stuff out of the entire forest. What they do is they burn channels through it.
Yeah. But, so I mean, it's a very nerve-wracking, very difficult event.
It's problematic if you don't have good weather for it, yeah.
But in the National Lakeshore is probably 1/100th the size of, or 1/1,000th the size of these areas in California, and you're like, and these guys are nervous as can be and doing it for their little bit. They got the trucks out there, and they're ready to go in case something happens. Plus, it's never even that dry like it is. I mean, we don't get California dry here.
Yeah, but I mean, so the idea is you clear channels through underbrush so that a fire that's burning is, you know, hits an area for lack of fuel, and if it doesn't jump that line then, or that channel, then that's a way of containing it. Mainly, they're doing this now around communities and structures up here to try to, again, build a less combustible zone around these areas. We've cleared almost all of this stuff 100 feet around our house.
Yeah, what was it? You, it was one of the guests was saying that one of the co-hosts was talking about in Hawaii, you know, people let the foliage come right up to their house instead of giving themselves 100 feet or a couple hundred feet around them if they could. That's why it runs right up to the house. I mean, it might anyway, but you don't even give yourself a fighting chance if the underbrush is leaning against your wall of your house.
Well, right, and so we all of us up there have wood burning fireplaces or wood burning stoves, and we have stockpiles of logs and fuel for the wood burning stuff, and we're all told, move that at least 60 feet away from the house and try not to have it, you know, try not to have it there. Don't have large wooden decks that provide an easy ignition source right up against your house. And if you do, treat that with stuff, coat it so that it's less flammable. A number of places now are putting sprinkler systems, outdoor sprinkler systems, in place that will start spraying, water on your roof to break the fire chain. There's a real technology that's starting to develop around this stuff as the economic risks for this get higher and higher.
Well, without a doubt. I mean, it's I tell you what, we're getting stuff here, and it's nothing on this kind of scale, but they just had a storm last week here. I'm going to say when I was growing up, which, you know, a while ago, but I mean, I could remember a few times, you know, some hail popping down and like landing on the grass or something. I don't know if anybody ever got any hail damage. Well, now in the last 3 years, you know, this whole southwest area, Orlin, Tinley Park, they've had probably 3 or 4 storms. The tomato plants I planted out of Audrey's all got shredded the other day. I mean, they're no good. It looks like you put bullet holes in the tomatoes. I mean, she might have roof damage again, and she's got a new roof. I mean, I've never seen anything like that here. I mean, it was a very unusual event, but this is like, you know, 3 or 4 times in the last, you know, couple of years where people have had, you know, 4 inches or 3 inches of hail on their deck in the summertime. I mean, that never happened here. I mean, this is every storm now is like, you know, trees uprooted all over the damn place. The fence company that she used to put her fence up, and one of the trees next door landed on the fence. Well, they pulled the fence up, so it was okay, but it still needed to be fixed. The guy told her after the storm a month ago, he got 1,000 calls the next day.
Well, if you had come when I moved out here in 2017, I was, you know, noticing as I was driving around, hundreds of cars that looked like somebody had taken a ball-peen hammer and just gone over the entire upper surface of the car, driving around. And they were the result of, I think, one major storm that came through and hit one of the auto rows, you know, the section of town where you have, you know, 5 or 6 major auto dealers.
Yeah.
And the cars were all parked out there. And this was golf ball, and to use the National Weather Service's latest descriptive term, lime-sized hail that came in in a major swath. You know, hail typically is a fairly narrow band, relatively. This was huge, and it came through, ran right down this area, and I mean it dented, I mean, thousands of cars, and they just sold them at a discount. Hail damaged cars, so people were driving these cars that looked terrible. You know, they were fully functional, but just you know, looked like they'd been in a demolition derby.
There was I just saw him a couple of weeks ago for the first time in God knows how many years. The guy used to trade. He stood right in front of me in the OEX pit, so he knew the people around you like really well. I mean, you spent 8 hours a day standing next to him, and he left the floor and he bought some kind of a electric. Anyway, they put underground something in South Carolina where Hurricane Hugo was, right? Because the hurricane damaged a lot of the overhead wires or something. Anyway, he bought this place from this old retired couple. But that's kind of not the story. I was looking at the time, and this had to be, you know, before 2000. I looked until Hurricane Hugo. What city they were in? Was it? In one of the South Carolina, what's the port in Charlotte? One of the Charlotte, right? Anyway, before Hurricane Hugo, the single biggest insurance event in the country was a massive hailstorm in Orlando where they had to fix like 100,000 cars or something. It was bigger than any hurricane because I mean, auto insurance company pays off for hurricanes. They don't want to pay you off. Oh no, it was the wind. Oh no, it was the water. By the way, let me read your policy. You're not covered water. It must have been water. No type of thing, but the car company, the car guys pay off, and they. Well, what do? And the car's drivable, so you don't total the thing. But what do? You have a tail damage. You buy it from the guy, and then somebody else can buy it and drive it like that.
Yeah. So that's one of the Denver stories. It's why our auto rates up here, our insurance rates are as high. When I moved from Chicago to Denver, I thought, okay. Now my insurance rates are going to go down because I'm out of a much higher crime area. Wrong-o. My auto insurance stayed just about the same, maybe a little bit higher here. In part, well, Denver was the auto theft because of our wonderful criminal justice policies. Denver was the auto theft capital of the country for a while. But in addition, the weather damage from hail jacked everybody's rates up through the roof. So, and then you need it in the roof.
Well, what I don't know if you've been listening at all, but the tie together between what's happened in the Middle East, and I'm hoping that this ceasefire finally holds, but we'll see. the tie together between that and the what's going on in the market, and the amount of larceny that's coming out of Washington from all kinds of different levels. It really is something. I mean, the idea that I was reading something last night because I've been talking about it all week, but nobody else is, I guess. Of how the jumping into the Japanese yen market last Friday morning.
Yeah, I heard you guys talking about that. I had not seen that story. So somebody left a notepad.
That's somebody, the Secretary of the Treasury.
Okay, Secretary of the Treasury left a notepad or a notebook open. With his notes on it,
yeah,
that said buy yen.
Oh, he said they were going to buy yen. The okay. Treasury.
So they were.
It was on his to-do list.
And my understanding is that we were doing that to prop it up.
Well, right. There's. I mean, I've talked maybe not so much
because the president got questioned about this Thursday night or something like that. Why are we buying Japanese yen? And he said some off the wall comment about, you know, we're supporting them. They're a good ally. So I presume that's what it was related to.
Well, I've been talking for 2 months now, and of course, nobody cares about currencies, but because of the oil situation, Japan buys oil, right? I mean, they don't have any of their own, so they buy it. But they got a double whammy because oil trades legitimately in dollars. So they need to buy the dollars and then buy the oil. So in the meantime, their Japanese yen is going down in value. So they've got a problem there. When it gets to 160 yen to the dollar, that's usually their panic spot. So they've been intervening on their own and doing basically a horse bleep job at it. So the yen got all the way to 163.5, which is really the danger zone for them. And but now the trick side of that is, if they're gonna buy the yen with dollars, how they get the dollars is usually to sell U.S. Treasuries, because we owe them like $1 billion or $1 trillion. So of course, since we have such a massive deficit here, the last thing our Secretary of Treasury wants is to is to have the Japanese not show up at the next auction, right? Or even a little bit less.
Yeah, but that's been the case for some time.
Yeah, well, but it's getting worse and worse.
So I'm sure, yeah, absolutely.
So they decide to go and buy $10 billion worth of Japanese yen, which is really almost the same, because the money enters the system, which is the part that, you know, I don't fully understand how it all, but that's how the money enters the system. It's the same as them buying the market, really. So on Friday morning, after we had the big rally, a lot of bleep happened last week. We had the huge sell-off after the Fed guy came out and basically laid an egg. So we had this huge sell-off. The next morning, that night, they took out this one guy who had his $20 billion account. And they puked that guy out and gave his stock to like Citadel and other people at a discount.
Who's they?
Either Morgan or Goldman, one of the two, or both.
All right, so a private investment firm, and what did they do?
Some guy started with, I don't know, $300 million, but where he got it, I have no idea. And he built it up to like $20 billion.
Is this a private
guy? Oh, yeah, some knucklehead.
Okay.
Well, he wasn't a knucklehead, but he was all over these AI stocks and everything, and he just made a fortune, and he was doing it all on margin. So when the thing started going back down, he's getting margin calls. So they essentially take the guy out on the low and kick the money to, like, Citadel and those people at a discount. Now, why can't you sell stuff in the open market? I have no idea, but that's kind of what they do. They've been sleazebags forever, Lou, these big firms, and they take people out. They have no mercy, even though it's the person's their client. But anywho, that was part of the deal, on which would have been Wednesday night. So on Thursday, we have this huge rally, which maybe because of the leak of this. I mean, I was sitting here doing a show Thursday, Friday. I mean, it was after I talked to you. I'm like, something's going on here. This isn't just a normal bounce back rally. You know, we went down a little too much yesterday, maybe, and we're going to bounce up today. I mean, the Fed guy didn't say anything that bad, so I don't know why we had the big sell off. So we come back some, and I'm going, you know, this is just a normal bounce back by the dip. I mean, nothing to write home about. But it keeps going. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. There's a piece of news out here someplace that I don't have, that somebody has. And sure enough, Friday morning, where you think maybe we'd have to actually back off a little bit, just at the end of the show, I see these S&Ps and the NASDAQ run like a scalded cat. And I'm going, okay, something's going on here. Well, Friday morning is when they entered the yen market. But they didn't just drive it from 163 like down to 161. They drove it down to 157. Which is like a 4% move in a currency, which buries anybody who's on the wrong side of that thing. But the weird part was, well, if you do it right away, you can actually go to CNBC, and you can get a day chart the day before, almost like minute to minute. And I discovered that when the yen move, might be off by a little bit, at 9 o'clock Central, so it would have been 8 o'clock Eastern, right when we're done with the show.
All right. So, Thursday morning.
And it's on Friday morning.
All right. So that's when the yen moved. Okay.
So, but the problem was, well, not the problem was, but the as we worry about, you know, what some homeless guy might have stolen, 15, 20 minutes before, the NASDAQ and the S&P started to move. So somebody front ran the yen trade by 20 minutes to 30 minutes. Some group of somebody's. And had to make a fortune between the two of them. So then he says, I would put $10 billion of yen, and oh, by the way, that's kind of, there's more where that came from, which essentially tells the market that as long as he's in charge, the market's not going down, and whatever they have to do, they're going to put it in there. And oh, by the way, let inflation be damned, because this essentially is more money in the system, which is very inflationary. But you can't be in a situation if Japan, you know, we owe them so much dough, them and the UK, that if they don't show up for these auctions, we got a problem. So, I mean, this big mess we're in. It all sort of ties together in a lot of ways. But the fact is, the front-running people are still front-running. They seem to have the absolute go-ahead of this administration. Matter of fact, they're participating. The only good news on the week, Lou, is that there were six congressmen that bought SpaceX after it came out. Four Republicans, two Democrats, so this is not one side of the aisle. I'm sure it's probably somebody in the middle of the aisle that's doing it. And all of them are on a committee, various committees that at some point will be called upon to do something with SpaceX.
So they bought SpaceX at the IPO?
Well, no, they bought it like the next day.
Okay.
Which means the assholes probably bought it at 160, 170, and now it's 111. So that at least we got that to cheer for. We got that to cheer about a little.
So that blows up your front running theory.
No, it doesn't mean every front running doesn't mean you're always right.
Okay, so let me just make sure I understand this. Somebody, if I understand your timing point, somebody invested or bought Japanese yen at the discount.
Somebody was the U.S. Treasury bought the Japanese yen.
Well, but no, but somebody was out in front of that.
Yes,
that's what you're saying.
Yes.
Who?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not the SEC, and they're not looking.
Well, okay. How do we know? Because I'm trying to connect the dots in my head. Remember, I'm a neophyte at this stuff. How do we know that there was there some kind of a run in advance?
The S&P, the NASDAQ futures went up 500 points when 20 minutes before the yen trade took place.
Okay. All right, so the futures, somebody got in there in the futures market.
And you know, we're not exactly trying to find out who the knaves are. I mean, we don't do that.
Well, how do you know they're not trying to find that out?
Because once in a while they'd find somebody. The only time they find somebody from front running, it's always some guy from India or Hong Kong or someplace. It's never the people who are supposed to front run.
Well, okay. So we have a reasonably good theory that the stuff leaked somewhere. We don't know who it was. We don't know whether it was Japanese from the Japan side or from our side. Presumably they will look at it. Somebody's looking at it, I promise you, because if it's that obvious, if we're talking about it, and if I understand it, it's obvious enough that somebody in law enforcement would pick up on it. It wouldn't surprise. I'm sure somebody's looking at it. Whoever it was, we don't know. May or may not get prosecuted if they get the evidence. I must say, this craziness about the reflecting pond is. diverting at least some of the Department of Justice people.
Can you imagine that meeting between that lady and the Department of Interior guy in the Oval Office?
That lady, Jean Pirro.
Yeah, you imagine that meeting?
I've sat in on meetings like that with clients.
Well, evidently they were high pitched voices yelling at each other. The two of them supposedly.
I've been in those meetings. I've been as both as a prosecutor and as an attorney who has got a client that says, I want to sue somebody. Find somebody. This is, I'm furious at whatever has happened with my business, my project, my Air Force base. And I don't care, what the evidence says. I want somebody dragged into court. That doesn't surprise me a bit. I've been there, done that. It is really uncomfortable. And your job as a lawyer, your first job as a lawyer in a situation like this, and this goes back to the ethics discussion that you and Kevin were having yesterday.
Yep.
Your first job as a lawyer is to try to get the client what it wants. So your client comes to you and says, here's my problem. I want this. Your job is to try to get it to yes. Sometimes you can't do that, though. And your job as the lawyer then is to go to the client and say, as delicately as possible, what you want to do can't be done in the way you want to do it. And the most difficult clients that you have are the people who come in and say, I want this, and I want it done this way. And I've often told you that the president reminds me in a lot of ways of my absolute worst clients. And that, this is an example. He is furious about the fact that, and then again, I don't know what somebody told him. The worst situation to be in is to be a lawyer who says, listen, we can get this guy. You set the expectation high, and then suddenly it turns out that the evidence isn't there. And you have, you know, your client now has an expectation that you're gonna, in this case, throw somebody in jail who's ruined your project. And suddenly it's not, the evidence for it just isn't there.
Well, I spotted it. There was an article yesterday, some lady, evidently she's not the lead person. This person's the lead person because I guess he's an Olympian or something, or former. Some lady was walking along, she goes, all this crap is floating on the top of the pool. So I reached down and picked up a piece of the thing floating, and a guy comes by in uniform. He says, I'm sorry you did that. Now I got to arrest you. She goes, what for? Well, for vandalism. She goes, it's a piece of paint floating on the top of the water. What are you talking about? She wanted a souvenir. The guy arrested her.
Well, and again, the groundwork for all of this was laid by actual acts of vandalism that were reported. So that gets everybody all excited. I want to find somebody. We know it's been vandalized. I want to find somebody who and put him in jail.
Is it true that he? I saw pictures. Now the AI is out there. I don't believe any. Is it true that he drove his motorcade through the thing?
Through what?
The reflecting pant.
Why would he drive his motorcade into the reflecting pant?
That's a million dollar before it was filled up, after they put the paint in there.
I have no idea, but that sounds like...
I saw there were pictures of it all over the place.
It sounds like a physical impossibility.
Things only what? I don't know. They probably had ramps on the end. They were doing so. I don't know. It seemed like it was to me, too, but that would seem pretty bizarre.
In any event, the story, the larger point is that your job as a lawyer in that situation is to sit the client down and explain to him, you can't get there from here. You may want to do this, but we're not going to be able to. And you know, the uproar, I think, is the result of, again, people jumping too quick, moving too fast, making snap decisions, issuing snap statements. You know, the first word that gets to you on something like this is supposed to be right.
Well, the whole thing started with he wanted to fix the pool. The pool, I only was there once, and the pool looked pretty crummy. This is before Obama. And he
wanted to fix it.
But he also wanted to fix it in 2 or 3 weeks. And so he hired some guy that said, evidently the original guy who did it the first time said you can't do it in 2 or 3 weeks, and they didn't want him then. He got some other dude to do it, a no-bid deal.
And again, this goes back to getting that first opinion. But regardless, the point is that you've got a very difficult client, and if you're counsel for him, you've got to sit down and, you know, calmly try to walk through, look, we made this decision based on X. X no longer exists, or X was incorrect. So now we have to do something else. If you still want to get a prosecution on this, we have to do it this way. And as I said, your most difficult clients are the ones who tell you, I don't want to do it that way. I want it done this way. And then you have to sit down and explain to them, we can't do it. We don't have the evidence. We don't have, I mean, it'll be a miscarriage of justice. We'll lose the case. And so that's what's roiling some of D.C. this morning.
Well,
I am not optimistic about the Iranian plan.
I'm not either, but there has to be some, where do you see the end? I mean, the area seems to be tired of this. So to a certain extent, the area, the other people, the Saudis and those kinds of guys, I think are going to force some kind of a resolution at some point, because they don't want to get back. I mean,
we would love for the Saudis and the Gulf states to, you know, arm up and go to Iran and say, if you do this again, we're going to destroy you.
I think before then, they wanted to stop.
Well, maybe they do. I mean, one of the things that's happening here, and it wasn't apparent 4 or 5 months ago, but it is now, is that we are juggling about four or five different balls in the this point with respect to not just our economy, but the world's economy. And the perception that if we crash oil prices, that and by crashing, I mean drive them up through the roof. If we crash oil prices, then we're going to create a much bigger problem in the short term than a nuclear-armed Iran or an Iran that is uncontrollable. So we're keeping all those balls in the air. At the same time, we are trying to credibly degrade the Iranian military capability and their economy. And I think that's the real long-term. I mean, it's a slower, less dramatic sort of operation, but blockade and the sanctions are having an effect inside Iran. We're not getting video of it because they're obviously restricting it, but it's having an effect inside Iran, and it will gradually, close them down.
Yeah, you remember the scene in Hunt for Red October when the guy looks at the Russian guy still shooting torpedoes and says, "You arrogant ass, you've killed us."
Well,
you gotta be careful you don't do that.
Well, that's another ball that's in the air. But I think we're less worried about blowing up our economy in terms of permanently damaging it than we are permanently damaging the economy of our allies. And again, this focus here is to try to get the locals to manage the issue. And by the locals, I don't mean the Israelis. I mean the other Arab states.
Well, you might want to take a little more planning before you started if that was your goal.
But again, I guarantee you, the intelligence, and I know it because I quoted it myself, the intelligence that was coming out, and let's go back to sort of basic principles. This administration did a terrible job of explaining what we were doing and why we were doing it. And they've just done a lousy job of it. It's come out in dribs and drabs. It's been fractured. It's been going in three or four different directions at one time. So they get an F for messaging, which would have made this a little bit easier. But the intelligence, three or four months ago, was that if we can turn the oil off, they don't have a mechanism to get rid of it. They'll have to cap their production, and their economy tanks. And that was supposed to happen within a matter of a month or two. And that was the intelligence. Okay, the intelligence didn't work out. And so now
we also have the Israelis saying if you take the old guy out, they're not going to have a government. Turns out they got something.
Well, I mean, the Israelis know more than anybody, better than anybody, who they're dealing with there. The idea was that we would decapitate the leadership. That would, to a certain extent, paralyze them, and it did, to a certain extent, paralyze them while we get unfettered air access over the country. And we've got that. We still have that. And we can go wherever we want in there right
now.
Well,
the messaging goes back to long before this. I mean, We did the thing, was it 8 months ago, where we dropped our world's biggest bomb on this thing, and we had, the president come out and say, we've set their, how many years did we set their nuclear stuff back? So if you believed them then, you can't believe them now, because it's a totally separate story. I mean, everybody thought, okay, that was probably bad enough that we went and attacked somebody, but it appears we did it for the right reasons, and blah, 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 we don't want these guys with a nuclear weapon. And it was declared a fait accompli. So everybody.
Okay, so that worked.
So it's a problem 5 months later when you're bombing them again, saying, "Well, it first time didn't work. You told me it did."
But it worked for the limited purpose for which we were engaged.
I'm not talking about what are the intelligent Lou people like you purpose. I'm saying what the president said. That we knocked them back, a century. For he didn't say a century, but. We blew the whole thing to smithereens. They got no chance of a nuclear bomb now. It's basically what he told people.
Well, and so that was the objective, and we apparently accomplished almost all of it.
Well, if we did, we sure as hell didn't have to go back 6 months later.
Well, the 6 months later, okay. So I think these were two separate objectives. we cut off their ability to develop a weapon in the short term. At the same time, 6 months later, you know, they don't take the hint.
I'm not debating any of that. But you're the one who brought up the part about the message, saying if you just listen to the dude, we just did that. He totally exaggerated the success of the first mission. I think that's where the message on this one started to fall apart right away.
Well, I see it a little bit differently. I see it as the first part was successful, but we haven't really effectively articulated why we're doing the second part.
That's right.
I mean the message is out there, but you got to filter it through.
Okay,
literally dozens of pronouncements about other stuff.
The first time, and we don't want to beat this up too much, but the first time, if they just blew up one area and said this is one spot where we think is a hotbed of this stuff, and we took care of that, it's not a long term solution, but it gains us some time. If that would have been the message, round two would have been a hell of a lot easier to swallow.
Absolutely agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm with you on that. This is. This goes back to Gulf War II.
Yeah.
You know, the Bush people did a crappy job of sitting down and walking through this. Although they did a better job than this, we just had bad intel. But there was a fractured. I don't know if you remember the workup to that war. But
I remember
it was Colin
fractured. Powell on national TV at the United Nations making a fool out of himself, basically. Even though I really like Colin Powell. I mean
that's ultimately what happened, but the run up to that was crazy and again disjointed. So it was yellow cake, it was gas, it was
whatever you can think of, you lobbed into the speech.
That's right. That's exactly right. So we're lobbed into the justification. And it reflects a highly bureaucratized, multi-stovepipe kind of messaging and communication system that exists in Washington, and I mean one of the things that I think we desperately need is a clear, somebody to stand up and clearly delineate. Here's what we're doing. Here's how this happened. Here's our end goal if we know what it is, but we have, and here's what we're trying to do, but we have a president, and there, as I said, there are many things I like about the president, but there are things that drive me crazy, and he is not a guy who is good at disciplined, coherent messaging. He's just not. And hasn't been.
He could be the farthest away from that.
Yeah. So anyway, that I'm keeping my fingers crossed that we have rearranged our strategy to adjust, because in war, the other guy gets a vote. We have rearranged our strategy to deal with the situation that exists right now, and we're managing the political issues. As best we can, but I don't think anybody who is a student of the strategic balance in that area thinks that we are in a worse place now than we were a year ago. I don't.
Well, I mean, I want to open up another sort of can of worms. In that, yesterday we spent a lot of time with some people on. By the way, did a great job, I thought, of going through all these different economic systems. And what the actual definitions are and what they all mean. Because it seems to me, before I even started digging into it, we're tossing terms around, a lot of people are tossing terms around that they don't even understand, right? And by the way, you were right front and center in the whole thing, because I did a whole deep dive into the fascist economic system. And so I put about six of them out on the table yesterday, or maybe five, and did all the definitions, and we went through it, and Larissa was terrific. The funny part is, I went out last night to meet some of my judge and lawyer buddies, and of course, one of the contributors of the show, Will Namish, shows up, and the first thing, we start talking about, socialism versus capitalism. And of course, my Notre Dame guys, the right-wing dudes there, are all up in arms about these people that are calling themselves socialists.
The Democratic Socialists of America.
And I said, you know, they're not even socialists. I mean, why they're calling themselves that, I have no friggin' idea. But
because it's less frightening than communists.
Well, the major difference between socialism and capitalism is who owns stuff. Socialism, the government, or collectively, the stuff is owned. Where in capitalism, it's private. You own things privately with property laws and all those kinds of things. Well, none of these people, I don't think, are saying that, you know, you're going to give your house out to the up to the government or your business up to the government.
Oh yeah, they are.
I don't think so.
Yes, they are.
Well, okay, but if you go over in where was I? I was in Denmark. Okay, that's supposedly all socialists. No, it's not.
It's not.
But my point is, when people use the first thing I do when I get this conversation to somebody is define our system now. Oh yeah, it's capitalism. Well, no, it's not. What are you talking about? In some areas, it is. And I started with my observations of Germany, that going into the fascist thing when I was there in 1991, Lou. And I go, you know, actually, when I got on the plane, I couldn't wait to get out of there, Lou. Not because I didn't like the people; I loved them. The place was clean, all kinds of stuff. It was really pretty nice, and ladies were very nice. They liked me. It was a great trip, right? I got to talk to some great people. Everybody was a friggin' employee, Lou. There wasn't a trader anywhere. You worked for a bank. The banks controlled pretty much everything. They owned 60-70% of the stock in all the big companies. And then the banks had their nose up the ass of government. And even the lawyers, guys like you, the young guys, man, this really, really sucks. We don't get to be a partner until we're like 45, and nobody makes any money. We could never form a law firm and actually go to court and expect to ever win, because we don't have the long term. For young people, Lou, it sucked. It absolutely sucked. And when I left there, I go, God, I hope we never get like that. And here we are in my industry. There's no traders. Everybody works for somebody else. If you trade, you trade for somebody. We're going right. So when everybody talks about communism, which you know is so far away from me, or socialism, for a guy who traded the trading floor, I don't want to go that way either. But the whole point is, where are we going? I mean, where we're going, I don't like either. So, I mean, for somebody to say this is somehow capitalism, especially an old guy who managed to make some money 40 years ago and still riding it out, and not look around what's happening to people younger than him, you got to open your eyes before you say this is capitalism, because in a lot of ways it isn't. I mean, name me, I'll bet you can go through one hand to the other, but you're not going to need your toes. Name me 10 industries that you think are competitive. When I asked this from Larissa yesterday, I asked her, in all the money you spend, how much of it, of the 100 hours you spend, of your basket, how much of it goes to competitive, what you would say competitive, laissez-faire capitalist stuff? And she goes, oh, way less than half. Look, your electric bill, no. Your gas bill, no. Anything to do with hospitalization, no. It's some kind of a combination or oligarchy or some piece of crap. It's no way it's competitive.
They're overly regulated. But for example, I would say any industry where you have very small profit margins because of the competition.
Yeah, but name them. Barbers, bars, okay, hair salons.
Grocery stores,
to a certain extent. Okay.
Airlines, grocery stores.
Well, airlines, there's four of them left.
Pardon me?
There's four left.
But the profit margins in airlines are small because of the intense competition between the services. And what you're seeing right now is a breakout in terms of pricing as these competitive, very competitive businesses try to squeeze as much money out of people as they can.
Let's not have a discussion about airlines. The idea that those guys are competing, Lou, is a total farce.
I disagree.
Okay.
They're clearly competing.
Well, it's the mirage of competing. If one raises prices, the other guy raises their prices. Or it's a baggage. One guy puts baggage stuff in, the other guy puts baggage.
I disagree, and there are a number of smaller airlines that are working to compete against the major airlines for regional services. But it's heavily regulated. So grocery stores...
It's not regulated in terms of price like it used to be.
The medical for example, the medical equipment industry is highly competitive. Any number of our defense contractors are highly competitive.
You're the guy who sent me the list of how many combinations there have been in the last 25 years.
That doesn't change the fact that the industry itself right now is highly competitive. You have literally dozens of startups that are surfacing now that are challenging those consolidated industries. We've talked about
there are, when I talk about competition, I have a whole different view of it than you. I mean, you can look at small companies in the medical field, you know, coming up with drugs, and some people are doing research and
equipment. Yeah.
Okay, but they can't get anywhere. Whenever they get to a certain point, they get bought by a big guy.
The legal industry is highly competitive.
Okay.
You could start a law firm on your own. I could walk out tomorrow and start my own firm.
Okay. I'm saying we're not there yet. I'm looking at the direction we're going. I mean,
okay. So now it's the direction.
But if somebody says, I think we need Medicare for all, that doesn't make you a socialist. People are still going to own property.
I would say Medicare for all is moving the country in a socialist direction.
Okay, but if it was competitive now in terms of price and everything, I mean, there's going to be three or four hospital groups in Chicago in 5 years. You can say they're competing, but they're not. They're competing by commercials. They're competing to get you in the door, not competing in terms of price. There's all kinds of different ways of competition.
You asked me to give you some examples of competitive industries. I'm giving you examples where you have companies competing against each other. The startup barriers are if not zero, are at least reasonable. The Democratic Socialists of America have a very well-defined platform, and their candidates apparently subscribe to it. That involves, you know, I consider it to be anti-American. It involves essentially dismantling the American governmental system as we know it. And so, you know, those guys aren't going to get my vote.
I'm not going to get mine either. But if you actually look at the stuff yesterday, I mean I don't know as much about these guys as you do, but I don't think the only people in this country that are taking pieces of business for either themselves or the government is the Trump administration. What do you call that? How do you even define that?
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about we're going to take 20% of Intel and we're going to give them all our business.
Oh, okay. Yeah, government investment in those
What's
programs?
The difference between investment and taking them over, socialism?
I agree with you that government investment at significant blocks or in significant chunks is a step in the direction of ownership, and that I don't like it. I understand why we're doing it. It's a way of giving the government a stake in where it's putting its money.
You may know the answer to this question. Who actually gets it? I mean, is it if we take the U.S. of A takes 20% of Intel? Now, there was 20%, and you get the vote. What's the one place where Trump gets to pick the board? What was that place? Was it U.S. Steel? U.S. Steel.
I think it was U.S. Steel. But
when Trump's gone, does this pass to the next president, or does it stay with Trump and his kid, or what? I mean,
presumably it stays with the government because it's government investment. I haven't looked at those documents.
Yeah, so I wonder what they even say. I mean, who?
But you know, that kind of return on investment has been done before.
Where?
And, pardon me?
Where?
Well, with one of the Chrysler bailouts.
Okay, but that.
With a number of other defense investments where we are putting chunks of money into these programs and asking for a return, and that money goes back to the Treasury.
But
if we sell, I'm aware of at least historically within the last 20 years where the government has sold its investment or its block of stock in companies in which it's in, into which it's put money.
And those proceeds
return to the Treasury.
And I think you're with me on this. I'm kind of tired of the whataboutisms, but there's kind of no comparison between. It's sort of like people will say now, you always paid college kids. Wait a minute. You gave the college kid a Greyhound bus ticket to go to his uncle's funeral. It's not the same as giving the guy $50,000 a month. I mean, but the Lee Iacocca situation with Chrysler, we were down. The government allowed us to get to three auto companies when we used to have, what, in the 20s, how many we have, 20, 30? I mean, and we really didn't have a lot of competition from overseas yet. So we essentially got to this oligopoly, and one group was having trouble, and they needed some money to stay in business. I mean, he spent, in his book, what he said, how many pairs of shoes he wore out going from congressman to congressman. Nobody wanted to do it. Even he didn't want to do it, but it was a loan. It was short term. And the minute the government could get out of it, they got out of it. The whole mentality was different for that situation than the current mantra. No, I want to be in control of this place. I mean, I want to be on the board of U.S. Steel. I want to control Intel. I mean, it's a very fascist system, which is the one you brought up.
I agree. Well, or socialist, depending on how you want to look at it. If it's ownership, it's socialist. If it's effective co-opting, like we have in China, it's or Russia, it's fascist.
Yeah.
But or Chicago.
I don't understand why I sit here and trade stocks from people all day long, and once in a while we trade some bonds. You know, we don't do that, but if somebody has one, we'll do it. I happen to believe in our system like this. I think if you got a good idea, the market will get you money. I don't think we need the government promising people business and then getting an investment and something on the side. We don't need any of that, I don't think. But maybe we do.
You do in certain industries, like defense.
Yes.
Certain pharmaceutical products. If the government doesn't do the investment, the drugs don't get developed. And you want the drugs developed because you need a just-in-case scenario. I see Mr. Madsen and
the guy's
Mr.
Right.
Krieg.
You stay away from any fires, will you?
I'm not playing with matches anymore. Let me put it that way.
This Spokane thing—that's almost like the thing in California, isn't it? Good Lord!
I'm sorry.
It's almost like the thing in California where the big city right on the water burned down a few years ago. What was the name?
Oh, Malibu.
What the hell was it? It wasn't Malibu. Malibu was one of them. What's the one where the whole thing went down? It was right. Gorgeous place. Was it Pacific Heights? It was something.
You're talking about Pacific Palisades.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
What is this? By the way, what is.
That burned. That was in the hills, and that burned down to Malibu.
What? Has there been reconstruction there of any kind? I mean,
nope. Nope. Total scandal.
We have our guys on in a second. Nancy says one of the problems with that is the new codes, even if you give somebody replacement value of the old house, it's not enough to put the new house up with the new codes.
Yeah, they've effectively blocked reconstruction there. There's a real great conspiracy about that I'm sure Wayne or Andrew can tell you about.
Well, you know, my sister-in-law or her cousin had a place in Florida, and you know, I told you the story about the idiots left their cars in the lot, so when the water came in, the cars were banging into the building on, like, the fifth floor. She's still paying her mortgage, and that was 3 years ago. They still aren't telling them whether the building's coming down or they're going to fix it. Can't go in. And she's still paying her mortgage. What was that, 3 years ago, 4 years ago?
And that's why we get nervous about government intrusion into too much area.
Well,
in too many areas. All right, boss.
All right, take care of yourself.
Have a good weekend.
SP Futures up 7, NASDAQ Futures on 179. Guys, how are you?
Very good. How are you?
All right. I'm still reeling from me trying to define the different economic systems yesterday, and I made it to the bar, and one guy says, no, that's not socialism. I looked at him, I go, who the hell are you, Merriam-Webster? All I'm doing is telling you what the definitions are. You got your own. Have your own. Have your own.
The one that's often forgotten about is kleptocracy.
Yes.
And I think we're heavy into that right now.
Well, we're definitely into a plutocracy.
Oh, yeah.
for those who don't.
Let me weigh in for a moment after my good morning. I think part of the confusion is deliberate, because we have political activists or players, and they are working with strategists and propagandists, and so people seize on terms that most of us think we know what it means, but some of the people acting on this are deliberately creating confusion, because their goals won't sell if they talk about what they're actually trying to do. So a great example is Medicare for All. Now, that sounds familiar, harmless to some people, I guess, and it's a slogan, but it really means single payer, which is abolishing private insurance, which cannot possibly succeed. So instead of calling their plan single payer, which is meaningful but a little confusing and not saleable, they call it Medicare for All. And it's, particularly with the results in Michigan and New York, a similar thing is going on with the Democratic Socialists, and that was what you were talking about both, I guess, last night at the bar, but also with Lou. And there you have a whole variety of people, some of whom actually are close to communists, and others, they don't kind of know what they're talking about. They're just joining the bandwagon, and they really just want better health care.
Well, and also, I mean, they're kind of, well, this would sound horrible, they're no dumber than somebody who looks at our current situation and says, well, yeah, we're all capitalism. Well, no, we're not.
You know.
Yeah, there's a lot of nuance, and the problem is that most of us, we just want to live our lives and not get into
detailed. Push back stuff. A hair on the Medicare thing. I think there's a split there in the, I'm sure you know somebody who's over 65. If they go in the hospital, they go to the doctor, there's going to be a list price. And then there's going to be a price that Medicare will pay. And it's a lot lower than the list price. So I think some people are espousing the idea that the Medicare price for all, not the Medicare system for all. There's a difference there.
Well, we saw in the Michigan Senate results that both Wayne and I tracked pretty carefully where the votes are. And places like Ann Arbor, a lot of young people, a lot of, I'll leave out any other descriptions, but they're not intimately familiar with Medicare, so maybe they think, oh, you just, people who are eligible, you just go in and Medicare pays for everything. Why can't it be like that for everybody, including them? But it's not like that at all, that you hinted at or suggested. You know, there's.
Well, I'm very curious as to why the Medicare price is a quarter of what the list price is.
Yeah, and plus the system would crater instantly if you just made everybody eligible. So you have to figure out a taxing regime. These people are not thinking it through. They're buying a slogan, which is intentionally fostered by people like Bernie Sanders.
Yep.
Because they know that if they truly describe what they're talking about, that's the end of their momentum.
I think Bernie Sanders is one, you know, if I was going to be nice, I mean, I don't want anything bad to happen to anybody. But I think what I could do to insult the crap out of that guy, I need to send him a calculator. I've heard the dude on TV saying if we just put a tax on stock trades, we could repay all student loan debt. I'm going, I want to see that calculator.
Well, I don't want to put Wayne on the spot, but if you want, someone who's motivated to give insults against Bernie Sanders. Wayne is the guy. I don't know if he can, on short notice, make them really funny, but he doesn't like a lot of what he's doing.
Well, I always say this about Bernie Sanders. His mind is still back when he was an activist, anti-Vietnam War protesters, standing there at some demonstration with a fold-up card table with a bunch of militant workers' newspapers on the table, telling people, "No, they're not free. They're 75 cents," and of course they weren't worth the paper they were printed on. But that's essentially Bernie has not really, how should I say, matured beyond those early days.
I don't think so either. Two kind of very troubling things. One with some Larissa yesterday. She, and I think, Andrew, you hit the nail right on the head, which is a way of overused expression. She says, in college, nobody thinks that this, I mean, I've been chirping like a goofball for as long as I've been on the show, that in my opinion, since the year 2000, and clearly since the year 2007, 80 to 85% of the population has been in a minor recession the whole way, in terms of what they make versus expenses versus other stuff. I mean, it's not even close. You know, some people have managed to do well with investments and so forth, which is fine. My clients, you know, and they've been above the fray, mostly because of investments, and not really because of income. Your house went up, your stocks went up. I mean, I think I could. You know, I could have that debate with anybody, and I think I could hold my own. I think it's absolutely true. So to think that people younger now who look at the world differently than we did, because they don't see necessarily a future for themselves. They're working for somebody else. They're working for some big company. They hate the place. Nobody ever gets a raise. People get laid off all the time. You're never going to be the president. You're never going to own this or that, your own firm. I mean, it's, the young people right now, according to Larissa, they're all for whatever. I don't know if anybody could define it. They're all for socialism because they think this for them sucks. And I'm not 100% that they're not doing better than they think they are. But the fact is, it sort of does suck compared to what we were used to when we grew up. So they're going to go after any alternative system, regardless what the name is. Without even worrying about whether what the name means, right? I mean, I don't think any of them are thinking that they're for the government going and getting somebody's auto repair shop and they own it then like a kibbutz. I mean, nobody's thinking that. I don't think. But the other one was one of my friends, his daughter's she's in college now somewhere, and she said everybody in college, she goes, is going forward. He thinks the Jewish people have a real problem. Because young people are convinced, and this is a gross generalization, that this thing in Gaza was way over the top, way too many people have gotten killed, and they don't separate out, like I think I do and maybe you do. I think Israeli people have a bad leader. They're not killers. This guy has a problem, and I've said that since day one when he got in there. But to young people, it just looks like this is incredibly uneven. And I'm sure they don't know the history, and they don't know this and that. But the fact is, this is the impression. I mean, and both of those really kind of worry me, to be honest with you.
And it's an international phenomenon right now. The issue is that in this country, I feel more comfortable that people may be going over whatever you want to call them, democratic socialists or social democrats or whatnot. But you see the opposite, unfortunately, now in Europe, where you've got young people in the same situation. But you take a country like Germany. Now you see a lot of young people saying, we don't like the social democrats take on things, and they're going to this neo-Nazi party, the alternative for Deutschland, And they've got elections coming up, and we may now see governments in at least the German states being totally this neo-Nazi party. And, you know, it used to be that the Germans would say, well, don't talk to us about that. We've been through that, and we'll never go back to that. Unfortunately, in some parts of Germany, they looks like they are going back to that.
Wayne, I don't know. What I saw in 1991, I don't know how they weren't revolting then. I don't know what you've revolted into, but, I mean, it was so cloistered. I mean, who controlled everything, the banks and the big firms? You were people didn't own the stock. The banks owned the stock.
Well, remember, back in 91, and you probably saw this, there was a lot of disparity between the West Germans, and they reunited, remember,
yeah,
the year before, and the West Germans were holding, they had to pay all the bills, right? They brought in, you know, East Germany in five different provinces, basically, and they inherited a mess. But, you know, a lot of West Germans were saying, wait a minute, what are we paying for these guys for?
Yeah, well, were you ever over there? Lou said he was there before.
Yeah.
I didn't, you know, I guess I should have realized it, but, you know, you don't know if you're not there. You know, you saw the pictures of the Berlin Wall in Berlin. He said the wall extended the entire country. I guess I should have known that. But
yeah, it wasn't a wall. I've been there a few times. It wasn't a wall. Outside of Berlin, it became like barbed wire fencing and minefields. But it still was a border. You couldn't.
So you couldn't even walk across a cornfield from one side to the other.
No, not unless you were very brave.
Well, I mean, I can't imagine that, the length of a country. I guess I got to open my mind a little bit.
Yeah, now you know where Trump got his idea for his fence on the Mexican border.
Oh God! well, I mean, yeah, the thing that these issues are—they're big. I mean, how do you get young people think that you can move along, and how do you combine what Lou just said? I mean, Andrew's probably more your area. How do you I mean, Lou is saying how competitive the defense industry is, and on some level, this is what's hard about, you know, actually doing the show or even trying to learn about this stuff. What you guys do, I mean, on some level, I think he's absolutely correct. There's people doing the drone stuff. There's people doing the software. There's probably a lot of people that are breaking in. There's new technologies, and I'm all for that. But it doesn't negate, I don't think I ever sent it to you guys, the piece of paper that Lou sent me 5 years ago that listed all these gazillion firms that were in the defense industry, that they're down to like 10. You know, there was like 100 combinations. I mean,
and what good that has it done?
No, I'm saying he's right about both of them. But I can't put them. How do you put them together, Andrew?
Trump sent out one of his social media things, and he says, "We're not out of munitions, and anyone who's leaking this, we're gonna, you know, come after you, and you're gonna go to jail for a long time." And then he says, "We've got plenty of munitions, and a lot of them we're expecting to come in from overseas." Are we buying munitions from other countries? And if we are, what does that say about our own defense infrastructure? And I don't think it's a good idea to be buying foreign bombs and missiles because of things like Trojan horse programs and, you know, things like that. So,
well, Andrew, how can they both be right? The piece of paper that says we've had a gazillion combinations in the industry. That's true. I mean, they did happen. But then also, we probably do have on the lower end for some of the new stuff, there probably is some competition. But how do you sum it up? How do you figure out whether we've gained or lost?
Here's how to sum it up, I think. Both things could be right. So I spent a lot of time, 15 years, in the high-tech sector with a lot of entrepreneurs and big companies would come in. And yes, it can be very competitive. So that's true. And part of our high tech was defense industry stuff, particularly in wireless communications. But if the people that are getting the big mega contracts are connected, yeah, the entrepreneurs are still there struggling over scraps and with hopes and dreams, but now you have not simply the lobbyists making sure that the big master contract, what would we call it, the umbrella contract, are going to the politically connected people. But now you literally have the Trump family buying into companies in one way or another, including getting on boards of startups in the defense industry and elsewhere. And so on top of a generally competitive system that Lute was talking about, we have amazing, breathtaking scandals. And as you pointed out in the previous hour, when I think Lou challenged you on examples, and you said, well, that's what the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, is supposed to be doing, but they're not. Because why would they be investigating a new drone manufacturer that has Don Jr. on its board? That's suicide.
Yeah. It's such a big combined mess. It's almost like you can't even discuss it because there's so many entrails to it. I mean,
well, we can discuss it here, which is why we have the show. But not on CBS News.
Well, it's too much for people. In the idea of one contract in one spot is 100 times more than all the little guys together that are snapping at the heels, like you're saying.
Well, exactly. I mean, take something that Wayne and I looked into because we had a great whistleblower who was heavily involved, which was one of the largest defense contracts in recent American history. And it was to supply refueling tankers for our Air Force plane.
I remember this.
And it was a total battle royal between Boeing, our typical U.S. company, and Airbus, which is heavily European, with important components from U.K., France, and Russia. And what they did was they created a U.S. subsidiary, Airbus USA, and they got incredible lobbying power and also got some dirt on some Boeing executives to scandalize the situation. Even though everybody thought, well, obviously Boeing's going to get the contract, Airbus had such a focused political strategy that was effective that for a long time it looked like they were going to get the contract.
Well, actually covered that. I don't know what the guest was I had at the time, but he was kind of all over this, Andrew. And it was, for those that, give me a chance, guys, I'll give a couple of minutes of history. The tankers that the Air Force used, if anybody can remember, you've probably heard the term, the 707, which was Boeing's original four-engine plane that basically changed the world, right? And then the DC-8 that came after it. Well, the 707, before the 707 even was the width that it is, there was a tanker contract with a fuselage. It actually was a little narrower, right? It was the K-130? What the hell is the name of the damn thing?
KC-135.
Yeah, but they were our tankers for God knows how many years, from 1950-something to whenever. And the Air Force said, okay, these things are like 60 years old. We better go get some new tankers. And Boeing's, nobody has a four-engine jet anymore. Or maybe the Airbus was a four-engine jet, but Boeing decided to use the 767 when it was coming off. They were just starting. They were going to not make those anymore, but they were going to essentially keep the line going with tankers. And I forget, was the Airbus a four-engine chap? I think it might have been. I'm not positive. But they went out for bid, and these guys are right, in the sense that they made them for them. You know, Airbus American, all this crap. I think the first time through, Airbus won the bid. And everybody here was outraged. Oh, my God, how could Boeing not get the contract? I think it was on the third try that Boeing ended up winning. Right, Andrew?
Yeah, I think so. And just to spice this up a little bit, one of the things that I'm laughing, maybe it's not funny, it's not funny, but one of the things Airbus was doing was getting evidence that certain Boeing officials were bribing a top procurement officer in the Pentagon.
Wasn't there a lady executive having an affair with one of the guys?
Yes.
I think her name was. And so they were getting all of this stuff, and I think she went to prison.
She did. Yeah, I covered part of that trial. It was over in Alexandria at the Eastern District.
Yeah. But thanks to our whistleblowing friends, Chief, we knew that, let's say, the Airbus people who put together the dossier on this were not pure of heart and mind. In fact, you know, they're doing all kinds of totally sinister stuff themselves. So it's a question of using the justice system in a, you know, very one-sided way to get the big master contract. And sure, maybe the people who are making the seat covers for the seats in the airplane, maybe they don't have that many in the tanker, but yeah, they're subcontractors. Maybe that's competitive, but the deal on who gets the master contract, multi-billions of dollars, is played at the most sinister and highest levels of not just U.S. intrigue, but international intrigue, because, you know, Russia, France, and Britain, they wanted that Airbus contract.
And so did John McCain.
John McCain, but also the senior senator from Alabama, Dick Shelby, held up, as he promised, every new appointment from the Obama administration in February of 2009 unless Airbus would get what he called a fair hearing. So as we...
Because they were going to build them where? In some southern state, right?
Yeah, they built an assembly plant in Mobile, Alabama.
Yeah, I knew it was south somewhere.
Which gave, you know, jobs down there in Alabama and talking points, but they're assembling parts that are mostly made in Europe.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as people think about these Trump appointments, Todd Blanche and everything, remember, I encourage us all, that one U.S. senator, through some arcane process of the Senate rules, was able to hold up every Obama appointment for after a presidential...
Yeah, I never understood that, but the when you say it's... You got to be careful. I mean, we like to split hairs on the show sometimes because I think it's important. Because you say, I know this, I worked at Pullman. You could say you built the railroad car, okay, but you really didn't. You assembled it. You built some of it, and you hung on. And when you do bidding, I actually spent a lot of time with a guy who was a international guy and doing bidding. If you go out for bid, and Andrew has been, by the way, very succinct with this morning, if you go out for bid and there's 15 people bidding on the contract, and this is not a case, there was only two, but if there were 15, it still doesn't necessarily mean that the bid is, quote, competitive. It is at that level. But now, I mean, I worked up several bids for Pullman. Okay, you have to buy, I'll use the name, Carrier air conditioners. They're going to go in the car. You have to buy Madsen trucks, you know, the wheel and axle combinations. You got to use, you know, Andrew Krieg seats. It's much more important to get your name in there that you're the truck manufacturer and let all the other assholes be competitive. You're not. They got to use your trucks, right? Or your air conditioners.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, so it's...
Of course,
go ahead, Andrew. I've been talking about
it. I was just going to say, of course, the air conditioning manufacturer, they've got a whole group of subcontractors there too with their lobbyists. So it's like teams going up against each other where there's an army of subcontractors and their lobbyists, and many of them are, you know, on the Boeing team or on the Airbus team.
Well, it's like one of the guys was an electrician, and he did these big, real big contract things, and I said, there's like IBM or somebody, you know, you got to use this huge piece of their equipment. He goes, no, once they get their piece of equipment into the bid, which might be 40% of the total of the bid, they don't want to do the other stuff. As long as their piece is in there, I mean, you don't care whether Airbus or Boeing wins if the spec says you got to use GE motors, right?
Yeah.
Because that's what? Motors, what, 40% of the price of a plane? The engines? Something like that, isn't it? Well, if you got to use your motors, you don't care about the rest of it. Isn't it amazing? Right. Isn't it an amazing world we live in, and how you guys always like to dig down into this? I love it because it just makes more questions and easier for me.
Well, it's amazing that you knew about this, although it was huge at the time, but it's in the dustbin of history now. But it was fascinating to at the time, and still important, but you were there too.
Well, I mean, the reason why is Pullman at one point, because the Amtrak contract was delayed, they hired all these guys from Boeing. So I knew a lot of the guys from Boeing and how they operated, and they would tell me all about the planes, because that's what they usually worked on, right? Not railroad cars. So that was where I got my education in this. It wasn't on the trading floor. It was before then. Because in those days, when you didn't have a computer on your desk, you got to wander around and talk to people. It was different than today. You sit there and, you know, do emails all day at your desk. Those days, I was a program manager, financial program manager, so I was able to go sit in these guys' office and talk about other stuff all day long, and nobody cared, right? I mean, because what was there to do at your desk? You had a 14-column piece of paper, and you had a phone. That was your desk, right? Remember those days?
Oh, yeah.
Let me squeeze in a quick thing before the break. One time I was covering a press conference at the National Press Club, maybe around 2010 on this, and it was by some top Pentagon person or former top, and I remember the quote, not so much who was saying it, but he said, well, a very important part about this is we need certain specs in case we go to war against China. And so there's about, 10 business reporters in there focused on, this discussion of Boeing versus Airbus. And I thought to myself, who the hell is talking about war against China? Isn't this the headline here?
Yeah.
And that we need an extra 200 miles or so of range in these refueling tankers to make sure that we're well prepared in a war against China. But, they're thinking about it, but the American public wasn't thinking about it then.
Andrew, did any of those, I've sort of dropped the story after Boeing got the thing. Are any of those ever delivered? I thought they had all kinds of problems with the production, too. Is our fleet now 767s? Did they ever fulfill the contract?
I think so. I think there are overruns, as usual. But we'd be hearing a lot more about it if they weren't.
Are all the other ones, the 135s, are they all retired? I don't think they are they?
No, they're still being used. As a matter of fact, you can go on these flight data websites, and you'll see these converted Boeing 707s. And especially in the Middle East.
Okay. S&P futures up 9, NASDAQ futures down 175. Come back. Guys, let's talk a little about the market and this Japanese yen trade and the fact that it seems to have gotten front run and how fast the SEC is trying to find out who front ran it. I don't think very fast. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control!
Right here, right now.
We're back. Well, welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tomo, Jim Lawler on the board. SP Futures up 9, NASDAQ Futures down 178. And we're trying to digest the huge rallies. We're down a little bit here, but not that much compared to how much we've been up. Dow Futures up 120. Got individual stocks. IBM down 5. I've got J.P. Morgan up 3.5. The big, huge mover has been this Caterpillar. It was up huge because they now have an area that's doing some AI, I guess, or at least that's what they're telling people. They've had a massive rally. Over in Asia, we've got the Nikkei down 617. It's 0.9%, so it's a lot. Hang Seng down 385. That's 1.5%. I'm not sure why those guys are down so much. Shanghai up 21.6% again. Seems like a lot of days now the Hang Seng and the Shanghai are going different directions for some reason. Over in Europe, DAX up 43.2%, FTSE up 8.1%, CAC around up 55.6%. So some bullishness over there, but very muted. Bonds up 3 basis points from interest rates, and not the bonds. Bonds would be down if interest rates are up. Interest rates up 3 basis points, 4.64 in the 10-year. Japan, 2.77. That's kind of the key number these days, what's going on in Japan and what we're doing. Oil up $1, 76.24, but still well under 80. RBOB, 288, so add something to that. The guys in Indiana are going to keep the gas tax off, so that saves you 40-some cents a gallon in Indiana. Got gold up $11. Gold has had a huge rally. It was down to almost under 4,000. Now it's 4,316. Silver down 43 cents, 61.55. Foreign exchange, again, this is what we have to look at. The euro is 115, so the dollar is down a little bit. It got below 114, all right? The Japanese yen, which was almost 164, is down to 157.89. Thank you, U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. A British pound, 134.6. Again, not as high as the 136 it almost was, or as low as the 133, so it's kind of moved back toward the middle here. Crypto. Down $345, 64,505. It's been amazingly steady around the 64,000 number for quite a while. Jimmy, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Cubs win.
Cubs did win, and it is the 6th of August at 7:37. Today on the inbound, Kennedy, we're at 18 minutes. The inbound Eden is at 32 minutes. Eisenhower is at we're at 71, the high is going to be 76. It is going to be some sun today with some passing showers. In Phoenix, once again, it is hot. It is 89 degrees with a high of 109. And as we had mentioned, Cubs win. Cubs against the Dodgers, 76. And unfortunately, the Sox lost. Against the Bo Sox, 4-0. Back to you.
Great joy in the Triple E Tap is the Bo Sox, the Boston bar. They think the Bo Sox are in contention for the wild card, so everybody's all happy. Hey, what the hell? I was gonna ask you guys. Is the Washington Nationals, is that still a hot ticket? I want to ask you a question. Plus, Jimmy, the Cubs are making a makeup game today. Is the ticket today the same ticket from the game in April or June or whatever they were here?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so that ticket, you need to use it today or you're out, right? They're playing who?
That is correct. They're playing the Toronto Blue Jays.
There you go. I'll bet some of those are available. Have you guys, I don't know, you're digging around in a lot of stuff, but Jamie Dimon came out this morning and was talking about, careful about the amount of margin on the market. You guys been following this at all, that the margin debt is up 20% in 3 months and with the market up this high?
I have not, but, Trump, he's always saying that, oh, the economy is great because the stock market's doing so well. But I think, I think we saw this in Michigan and other states in these recent elections, is what may be hot with Wall Street is not affecting Main Street. And a lot of Main Streets and a lot of small and medium-sized towns across the United States, they look like a neutron bomb hit them. All the people are gone, the buildings are still there. So I think there's a huge disconnect between what the late Alan Greenspan would call irrational exuberism.
Well, if you pour
exuberance, I should say.
If you pour money into the system, and I'll quote him because I had the dude for class. Milton Friedman says you got to be careful because it not only creates inflation, it's not even. Some people can raise prices, some people can't. Some businesses, you meant not people, some businesses can, some can't. And it's never even. And when you pour money into the system, and Hal's done a lot of work on this, because of the new banking laws and the amount of money pouring in, that combo has caused some people to be able to borrow money amazingly easily and other people not. And that's not inflation, that's just another aspect of the system. I mean, say a guy like Andrew wants to, let a few of the moss out of his wallet and calls PTI and wants to buy, 1,000 shares of IBM at 231. It's down 470 today. He has to send us a check for 116. I mean, he or anybody. And we don't have clients that do that. I mean, we have people that have margin loans, but we don't have anybody that does that. That's other firms, that's the mainstay of their business, because the most money you make in the business is not from doing trades, it's from interest. So that's where your places like Robinhood and places make money is on margin interest loans. And a lot of people don't understand that about brokerage firms. But when people say, you're trading for free, no, you're not. you're going out on a loan, you're probably going to pay God knows what, 7-8%, and they're gobbling that up. But anyway, I can get you a loan in 2 minutes, Andrew. But now if you want to get a loan for, say, a plumbing company or something, good luck with that. Maybe it's like pulling a wisdom tooth out of an alligator. I mean, the difference is dramatic. So it's so much easier to get margin. I mean, we're talking $300 billion in 3 months.
That's a danger sign. And it came up just yesterday when the Treasury Secretary took on exactly this issue, and he said, to paraphrase, look at the stock market. The economy is great. But what he was not addressing, even though he's got to know better, is the economy is much more than the stock market. To give one example, it's still fresh and weighing in my mind is we were on the trail of an Epstein scandal in Connecticut, which historically is one of the great manufacturing centers of the United States going back in the day. And we found ourselves on the main street of Naugatuck. And maybe, Wayne, can you share a brief impression of what that's like?
I mean, a nice old New England town, but there was hardly anything open. Everything seemed to have gone out of business, maybe except for some bank there on the corner, and of course there was the secondhand shop, which didn't have any customers in it. I don't know how they were able to stay in business, but they had a lot of, you know, old clothes and things like that. And the funny thing is that the guy who either was managing that shop or owned that shop, we started talking to him, and he probably was amazed that there were two guys walking down the street in that town. But he it looked like he was wearing a woman's hat. Now I don't know whether he knew the difference, but he looked like one of these hats that old ladies wear that has a little bit of a lace thing that comes down over you.
Yeah.
And some,
it was
and
really
some
tall. Almost like Abraham Lincoln's hat, or like at a gas station where they have the inflatable balloons that kind of attract attention. And so he was looking for some customers, and here we wander in. And we actually talked with the guy for a while, didn't see anybody else, and we thought, this is the most vibrant place in a very significant city in Connecticut. I mean, it was tough.
Well, one of the Bodias just made the comment that how could they not know? I think that the people we have, and this is not one side or the aisle or the other, I think these people have no connection whatsoever to some of the, when I say these people, it's a gross generalization, but I read just bits and pieces of it. It's been so long, I mean, I read the whole book now. I read so much other stuff during the day, but you read Geithner's book or any pieces of it?
Yeah, I've got it. I actually met him when he was selling it, and I think I have an autographed copy. I'll tell you why in a moment, because it's interesting, but please go ahead.
No, I'm saying, I remember the part in there where every time he was kind of a bleep-up in school, never really applied himself, and every time he kind of come back in college or wherever the hell he was, the old man would get him like a job as a intern like at the Federal Reserve or an intern at like the Supreme Court or someplace. That's how the old man showed him. You know, instead of getting him a job, you know, working construction on an expressway for a summer, like most blue collar people would tell their bleep up kid to do. I mean, his was just the other way. I mean, what in that guy? I mean, I'm not saying he's a bad guy or whatever. What in that guy's makeup, whatever, or Bessence or any. The market is that's their life. The guy's not.
Yeah.
He has massive amounts of investments. They go up every day. He's doing great. I mean, he's not living off his Secretary of Treasury salary. I mean, who's kidding who? So it's you know, when he says the market's doing great, everybody's doing great. Everybody he knows, he's talking about.
I mean, let me hop in. Even though Wayne's expert on Geithner, but I'm the one who bought the book. I don't know if you're talking about Bessent or Geithner.
I'm saying none of these guys have a clue of what the other guys get.
Here's why I bought the book. And I wanted to see, and I hit Pater, that there was one or two sentences in the middle of this tome, his memoirs of the Treasury Secretary, that I was looking to see whether he'd address it. And he did. And here's the key point. In the book, the memoir of Tim Geithner, Obama's first Treasury Secretary, who, remember, was appointed after he played an important role in the New York Fed in the meltdown, the collapse, the problems.
Hold up for a second. For those that don't know, when the Fed does, actually they do some of it out of Chicago now, but traditionally when the Fed makes a move, it's made by the Fed chair or the federal guy in New York. That's the key spot. Now, Chicago does some now, but it used to be like 90% of it was done out of the New York office. So he was the major guy, right?
He was a major guy in a huge, devastating financial problem, if people remember back then. And he was the nominee, and he scoots through, and very few people looked into his background. Well, Wayne is one of the guys who does look into this, so I'm kind of stealing his story, but let me get to the punchline. In the middle of the book, he says, in his meeting with President-elect Obama, he says, isn't it amazing that your mother used to work for my father? And he says, Obama laughed, and he says, yeah, what a coincidence, or something like that. And then they move on.
Coincidence, well, my ass.
What's that?
You know the story.
Yeah, so we won't get into the whole story, but the bottom line is people look at pictures back then and now, to the extent that they do, of Obama's mother and Stanley Dunham, and they see long hair and a middle-aged woman. She looks like some kind of hippie chick. Nice mother. She raised her son to be and became president, and she was some kind of, if people dig into it, some kind of anthropology person who was interested in primitive cultures in Asia. Well, Geithner's father, Peter Geithner, was a major executive at the Ford Foundation. And if she's working for the Ford Foundation, without getting into all the ramifications, in Asia, at a time of great tumult, you know, the collapse of Sukarno in Indonesia, the Vietnam War, all kinds of stuff, we could just leave it. She is far better connected than anyone except readers of Wayne's books could possibly imagine. And Geithner, in his memoir, wanted that one or two sentences so he could say, well, it's mentioned in my book, but he doesn't draw the implications that I'm only touching on here of how well connected the Obama family was, and helping lead to the presidency and a lot of decisions. And Wayne has actually written a book called The Manufacturing of a President that was, I think, published around 2010, 2000 or so, that lays this out, as he did in his columns beginning a couple of years before. But people have no idea what's behind some of these relationships of people in both parties.
So, well, I asked Lou.
Long-winded here, but
well, you know, you know, I remember with the different co-hosts saying, I asked Lou, yeah, when he first came on the show years ago, I said, what if somebody from the state of Illinois or whatever, and they wanted to a recommendation for somebody for this kind of position, you know, and Lou's a guy that, you know, for God's sake, he's a JAG attorney, he was an Air Force guy, he went to Duke Law School, I mean, the guy's, you know, we're not talking about a schlump. I said, what if, you know, what if somebody came back with, you know, a thing for you to run the Illinois Veterans for a few years or something? He goes, not only would I, they wonder who the hell I was, he goes, the person who came up with my name would never be asked again. I'm not in the quote loop, whereas, you know, there's only certain people get this shit, and it's, you know, and he goes, if you were to, like, if you were to say, you know, this guy Chief is a pretty good half-assed economist, and he's a pretty darn good money manager, and he's got an idea of what's going on in the markets. If somebody brought your name to the place, they not only would not want you, the guy who brought your name, they won't want him again either, because you're not, you know. What do they say in Chicago? what Chicago's real motto is, we don't want nobody, nobody sent?
Yeah. And there's reasons for that. It's not quite, I mean, it's getting much worse. So it happens that I attended President's first fundraiser of his entire campaign, and I paid the maximum amount, $2,300 then. I don't regret it, even. You know, I've learned a lot more about him. Only about a third of the people at this fundraiser even spoke to him. Part of it depended on how aggressive you were. And in my case, I just gave the donation, but I didn't try to pursue anything, really. Whereas some people who might only contribute $300, I knew some of those people, and they would use this relentlessly to try to get what they wanted out of the system when it's, you know, a trivial amount even then. And now it's laughably trivial.
Andrew, I was going to, maybe next week or the week after as we get into this political season. By the way, we're up to, now Willie Wilson's running for mayor. We got, like, I don't know how many people running for mayor. You should come back and run for mayor. I mean, for God's sake, everybody else is.
I saw Johnson's at a 13% approval rating. I mean,
you know what, though? I had every discussion you have with people these days turns into a Pier 6 brawl. I was mentioning to one of my friends who actually rents space in our place, an attorney. He's been on the show a few times. And I said, you know, as these numbers start to multiply, Johnson should run. And he looks at me and he goes, why? Everybody likes him. He's doing this. Nobody wants. I said, his name is Greg. I said, Greg, look, I'm not a fan. Boy, you get accused. All you got to do is say one thing these days. You get accused of stuff. I said, I'm not a fan of Johnson whatsoever. I said, but the dude is the incumbent. And you know, 4 years, 8 years ago, when Lori Lightfoot ran, there were a bunch of people in the stack. Because now the primary is not Democrat-Republican. It's just one primary. And the top two vote getters, if nobody gets 50%, which nobody will, they run in a runoff. I said, people forget, you know, Lori Lightfoot was a, you know, all kinds of votes when she ran against, what's her name? The lady who's a county lady. I'll think of the name in a second. I can see her face. All these names. Anyway, her vote total in the primary was 85,000 people, which is nothing. Tony Preckwinkel is the lady she ran against. And nobody liked Tony, so she won pretty big in that. Well, I'm going to say that Johnson is capable, between his school board stuff and the people he's done stuff for, there's no way the guy doesn't get 50,000 votes. And if you start getting 48 people running, that 50,000 gets him on in the primary or the runoff. I said I don't think he'll win the runoff, but I'm saying as you start to degrade, I mean, how many people are going to vote? 500,000? And if you've got 12 people running, 500,000 is probably too many. Say 400,000 are going to vote. The numbers get to the point where you've got something going for you. You're the incumbent. I mean, if he thinks that he can get in the runoff with 60,000 votes, I think he is almost at the stage now where he could. Certainly 75.
Well, and there's, to put a little sports analogy here, you know, you got a puncher's chance. Because you never know what kind of scandal the opposition has that might pop up. And just last night, talk about a time-wasting exercise, but maybe I'll get some value out of it. I was watching a tape of a 1967 fight of Ali against Zora Foley. And Foley came in with 70 victories. Most of them were knockouts and so forth. And Ali caught him on the point of the chin, and it wasn't even necessarily, you know, like you see in the movies, a power punch right in the full-on face, but it was the point of the chin that snapped his head, and he went down, and I've never seen anything quite like it, and he's a tough old Korean War veteran, you know, 70 victories in the heavyweight division. He tried to get up. He twirled around like Fred Astaire and did a flop. And it wasn't even necessarily a hard punch. But Ali caught him right on that point of the jaw that spins the head. And he was out.
He probably was walking into it.
Yeah, yeah. And he actually was protecting himself pretty well for most of the fight. This was in the seventh round. And it's just I hope there's some relevant analogy.
Well, I mean, the thing that, as we burrow into this, next week, if we can, because we only got a couple minutes today, I know the first thing on anybody's mouth is going to be Citizens United, but a lot of stuff had to happen from my last year on the board at the SIBO was 1998. And I can remember vividly, because I remember the people, us getting Tom Foley and all these other guys, probably was 15, 20 people. They were in town, we'd invite them to the SIBO. The SIBO, would invite them over. Me being on the board, I was always invited, and some people from the floor and some committee chairs. There'd be, you know, there's a big conference room. So there's Foley, his person with him, or maybe two. And but in those days, nobody had security, really. I mean, he had a person with him, maybe two, and there'd be, you know, some of the staff people. Say there'd be 20 people from the SIBO sitting there, and they'd explain what they, you know, a little bit about themselves, and then we'd tell them, and he says, what do you guys do, and blah. But I think, Andrew and Wayne, I think the number was $500 was all you could give the guy. So the guy's not going to fly to Chicago. You're not bribing Tom Foley for $500, I don't think. And, you know, plus he got a couple of cookies and some coffee. So how do you get from there? I mean, today, I'm not as familiar, and that's why next week let's go through it. Could the SIBO drop a $100,000 check down there now? Is it that different, or is it still somehow between the PACs and the other? I mean, how complicated can a regular old firm, if Tom Foley sat down today, could the SIBO write him a check for like $1 million and just it'd be okay?
Well, it's just not done that way. It's done through dark money, and I know we're finishing up, but there's just a news report today that a lot of the dark money people are creating their own news outlets. So there's one up in Alaska that Judd Legum wrote about this morning, and it looks like a news site, but it's really a dark money site created to cover the U.S. Senate race and make it look, when there's a lack of regular media, as if they're a legitimate nonpartisan news organization, but they're writing all of these puff stories about the Republican candidate, Dan Sullivan, how he's done all these great things that he hasn't really.
They're probably using AI to do it.
Yeah.
Very possible.
So it's far more effective to take an extra step. And here's a very quick thing, because, you know, the polls in Michigan showed Al Saeed, for the most part, winning by about 13 or 14 points. And actually, he won by less than 1 point in that big U.S. Senate race.
Really?
And here's a private theory I have about that. The polls were probably rigged and inflated, and the Republicans really lead the way in inflated, rigged polls to make their candidates look better. But here's the Democrat doing it and winning. And what that might have done is persuade the third candidate that was on the ballot to not endorse Haley Stevens, because she probably thought, well, Haley Stevens is going to lose, so why should I endorse him? But if the third candidate had actually aggressively endorsed Haley Stevens, who lost, she undoubtedly would have won. So there's a utility by the strategists of taking things to a much deeper level than simply donating money, and instead creating fake polls, fake news organizations, and all kinds of others.
What do you say we tee this one up next week? Jimmy, why don't you make a note? Take a note. Put it, what they say in The Quiet Man, put it in me book. You know, and we'll talk about this next week because we're getting close to this. S&P futures up 3. NASDAQ futures the other way, though, down 225. We'll be back tomorrow. Stocks. By the way, I'm sure all your friends in the SEC are wildly going after any front-running maybe of this Jen intervention. What do you think? Maybe no. Not? Anyway, guys, thank you. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks. Well, I got the same guy that came over, Lawrence, and he took care of it.
That's all, folks.